Across the Americas on Pan Am Saturn Galaxy, throughout Europe on the Astra Satellite System, and around the world on shortwave and internet. This is the Dutch International Service. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Jonathan Marks and Diana Jansen.
Hello and welcome to just over half an hour of news from the world of communications. Later on we'll be looking at Compact Disc Interactive and asking whether it's doomed to failure. But first, a look at media news.
Dutch computer enthusiasts have been showing off in the Dutch press again. This time they've demonstrated how they cope with the continually changing codes used to encrypt satellite television signals, like services from BSkyB or Filmnet. With MTV Europe due to scramble its signals in July, there's been heightened interest in computer circles on ways to crack the code. A Dutch hobby magazine recently published plans for a printed circuit board which slides into the card slot and uses a chip to unravel the signals. TV stations like Sky Movies then change the code several times a week, foiling the pirates. But now the old pirates are using internet to exchange the new codes and update their smart cards using a program called Season. BSkyB in London told us there will always be a percentage of illegal viewing, and only a tiny group have access to the sophisticated updating systems demonstrated so far. TV companies have been successful in prosecuting pirates for distributing illegal cards in Europe, but that costs time and money. It's no wonder, then, that satellite television operators are pushing for the switch to digital scrambling and transmission as fast as possible. That, they say, is going to be uneconomic to try and break, because codes can be changed several times a second. We'll see.
Media Network's News Review.
Now on the line is Arthur Cushion from Invercargill, New Zealand. Arthur, last week we were talking about the past. What have you heard in the last few days?
Well, there's some interesting news. Palau, and as mentioned by Victor, they have moved to 965, and the reason for the move is that Moscow is now on 9835 and they are on 9830. They open at 0800 in English, 0830 Chinese, 0930 English again to 1000. I spoke to the chief engineer. They're still using only one transmitter. There are two others. One is not being used. The third one is expected, but in time they will use three transmitters in the service. And from Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar, English to Australia, 0910, 0940, 9960 and 12,000. 9960 is a new frequency, but we can't hear it here. It's blocked by a teleprinter. And at 0300 to 0330, they're announcing to North America, and that's on the same frequencies, 9960 and 12,000. Here in New Zealand, ZLXA, the radio reading service in Levin, which is on 1602, 3935, 7290, is carrying WaveScan on Monday at 0800, and it's repeated at 2200. It's going to be formed into a sort of DX and radio amateur program in the near future. And Radio New Zealand International, they are using two new frequencies. They're on the air from 1645 to 1845 on 6145, Monday to Friday, from 0455 to 0715, 9570. And there is a frequency change for the last transmission, 0715 to 1206, and that's moved from 9700 back to 6100 kilohertz. A very interesting letter from Swaziland, Trans World Radio in English, are now 0700 to 1030 and 1900 to 2130 on 9500 kilohertz. They're using the Meriton transmitter in South Africa, 0701 to 0757 on 11730. A letter from the chief engineer indicates that the 50 kilowatt transmitter from Bonaire is now being installed. It will replace an old transmitter of 25 kilowatt, which goes back to the 1940s, and Swazilanders have to have FM from June.
This is Media Network, covering the full spectrum of the world of radio in a form easy to digest.
Even last year in the United States, which was the best year, and that's after we introduced the standard of CD-ROM 10 years ago, last year was the best year for CD-ROM penetration in the United States marketplace. And that's still a fraction of the installed base of either Sega or Nintendo, which are TV-based games platforms. So the PC still has a long way to go before it reaches the penetration levels of other systems. And if you compare it with television, it's a long, long way behind.
An interesting statement, which immediately takes us to a building in the south of the Netherlands, shaped like a spaceship. A company president is speaking.
De afgelopen jaar onze hele virusbevolking gevraagd wat zij nu vinden waar we nu staan.
Jan Timmer, the president of the Philips company, speaking at a series of one-day seminars being organized at the corporate headquarters in Eindhoven. Philips has managed to turn enormous losses into profits, but the new company realizes that the future will be a period of constant change. Sitting in the presentation theater, the message was very simple. Philips is trying to build new media services as fast as possible, but, like any commercial organization, doesn't yet know whether the public will ever pay for them.
People who make films and music recordings would like to be able to pump their entertainment directly into your home on demand, and when you use their products, they want you to pay for them. The cable systems in the Netherlands don't yet have the capacity to feed hundreds of channels into the home and monitor what people watch, so they can send a bill. It's estimated that it would cost about $10,000 million to equip every household in a small but densely populated country like the Netherlands with the kind of information pipeline that will permit video on demand. In other words, you choose a film and it's fed straight into your house immediately. No one has the money, at least not yet, to set up that sort of infrastructure. The next best thing is to put the same film out on five different television channels, but with the starting times 20 minutes apart.
Compact Disc Interactive, on the other hand, is one way of getting a lot of information into your home, although the disadvantage is that it's more difficult to update. In fact, you are giving them a 650 megabyte hard disk, which costs only 99 cents to press. The big change-around process in Philips was given the codename Operation Centurion when it was launched 5 years ago. There were three main cornerstones for the consumer electronics side of Philips. High-definition television was hailed as being important, but the death of the Mac format has put the launch of high-definition systems on hold. There's more interest in squeezing more channels into the same space than expanding the existing picture quality. The second pillar for Philips' success was to have been the replacement for the compact cassette, namely the digital compact cassette, better known as DCC. Although not completely written off, the promised explosion of the system has not happened, and even in the Netherlands, which has traditionally been a stronghold for Philips products, the rack of DCC pre-recorded tapes is meager in most record stores, alongside the thousands of compact disc titles. So that leaves the other main hope that Philips promised would change the company's fortunes, namely Compact Disc Interactive, or CDI. I spoke with John Hawkins, Executive Vice President of Philips Media, and suggested that CDI wasn't doing very well either. We've had quite a lot of reactions from listeners in the US and Asia who suggest that it's CD-ROM and not CDI that's successful in those markets.
Okay. In terms of major markets, we would also include Europe as being a major market. And if we look on a worldwide basis, CDI is doing exceptionally well. If we look to the Far East marketplace, that is not a marketplace where we're active right now with CDI. So I can understand if you checked in that particular marketplace, you wouldn't see much evidence of CDI. What I think you will find in that marketplace is a strong surgence of video CD, and clearly from a player point of view, CDI plays video CD software.
But in the US, the last 2 years, you spent about $36 million on promotion, and still it's not a big success.
I think if you look to the United States marketplace, it's a very difficult marketplace for everybody. I think you now have, the last time we counted up, there's seven different platforms in the US marketplace. At US retail, it's very difficult from a retail perspective for them to position all the different platforms. So I would say that the United States is a very difficult market for any multimedia platform today.
Philip still believes that most consumers will want to access entertainment through their television sets rather than bringing the home computer into the living room. Yet more computers were sold in the US last year than television receivers. Microsoft's Bill Gates was quoted recently as saying that CDI will exist as long as Philips continues making it. So isn't CDI long since out of date?
There are still more televisions out there than PCs. There are still more consumers out there that effectively don't understand a PC, are intimidated by a PC, and are not using the PC for entertainment purposes. And that is the real differentiation between CDI and CD-ROM, that CDI is plug-and-play software and it's entertainment-based and therefore TV-based, and CD-ROM is productivity and PC-based and tends to be plug-and-play software rather than plug-and-play.
So you say the PC is for the professional market and the TV is for the entertainment market?
I would say generally yes. I think if you were to analyze the penetration of CD-ROM, even in the United States marketplace, PCs still aren't breaking through the above the earning capability of $75,000 and below. That's the CD-ROM is really addressing the higher income PC literate user, and that isn't typically the average consumer in the United States.
But now you also offer a cartridge for a computer, so CD-ROM can be used in computers.
Yeah, the reason that we've offered the card into the PC is that as a publisher, we don't ignore the install base of CD-ROM PCs. What we believe is that there's a real opportunity for plug-and-play entertainment software, which is CDI-based, which gives us an opportunity to actually penetrate into the PC. So from a software point of view, we look at the volumes of multimedia PCs sold and think we have a better solution for entertainment software in that PC environment. But our experience of that PC world is that once you have a card upgrade capability, if that's generally well accepted, then that will eventually get integrated onto what we term the motherboard of the PC. So it would then become a standard facility on the PC.
CDI has enormous potential in the educational, the training and the professional aspect, information points, the support sales. Isn't that really where Philips also sees the potential and gradually will get out of this family entertainment business?
We see an opportunity for in both areas. We see it as a consumer, family entertainment product, but as you say, in the education environment, particularly where you have people who are either an age or at an education level where they effectively are not PC literate, and also for countries where, quite frankly, they're trying to enter into multimedia-based education, where they can buy a piece of hardware which is probably a fifth of the price of a multimedia PC, it means for them that they can bring multimedia for the masses with CDI.
So when will you introduce it in Africa?
This year we're branching out into some new territories, China, India, Brazil, to name but three, and we will also launch in Australia as well. It's not Africa, but it's a start and a move in the right direction.
Radio Netherlands in magnificent mono.
Philips has also been pushing the portability of the medium. The 12-inch laser disc was introduced in 1980, but proved to be much too large compared with the video cassette. The 5-inch compact disc is a much more convenient package, and Philips has been encouraging other companies to make portable players that can cope with the CDI format as well as regular audio.
We've actually seen a very interesting portable CDI player from Goldstar. So we see those players getting smaller, and we also see with the recent announcements that we've made with higher density discs that we can take the CDI application and we can put it onto a smaller disc for the future. So you can have a true portable CDI player for the future.
Traditionally, Philips was a hardware manufacturer. Now you move more and more to the software. How far will that go?
I think it will go all the way. We now, as Philips Media, are what we term a multi-platform publisher. So we develop content, and then we put that content onto a number of platforms, CDI, CD-ROM, but also other platforms if we think they're viable. And our role as Philips Media is to leverage that content over as many different platforms as possible. So we're already a software player. We've seen over the last 12 months that we've made significant inroads into becoming a leading CD-based entertainment player in this marketplace. If I, for example, take the UK and the Gallup polls that are published there, Philips Media are now number two in that marketplace, and the third player is a long way off of our position in terms of market share. So in a very short period of time, Philips Media has become a leading multimedia software publisher.
For the last 3 years, Philips has been investing in software for the consumer, with an excess of 300 titles now available. This, of course, still pales in comparison to the 1,500 titles for professional use and the tens of thousands of titles available worldwide on VHS videotape. HDTV has not been launched as a product, but DCC has, and it's not doing very well.
DCC is really taking what I would say is existing content, which is audio-based content, and using a different format to play that music. Multimedia, and specifically CDI, is generating new content, a new excitement and a new proposition as far as the consumer is concerned. And there's a tendency from consumers to want to integrate functions into one device. And CDI is excellent in terms of providing that combination player where you can play your audio, your photo CD, your video CD, so your movies, your games, reference, children's edutainment, all in one box. And we feel that consumers want to get more out of a piece of hardware than just one particular application. As far as movies on demand are concerned, we see that as being quite way off. And people will still want to own software and own packaged media. So therefore we see it as a complementary carrier, not a competing carrier.
John Hawkins. Well, of course, it remains to be seen what happens in the next 5 years, as the suppliers of software on compact disc have to battle with information providers that enter your home via cable or satellite. And of course, the main question is, will you want to pay for it?
Time will tell. Audience research shows that women watch more television here in the Netherlands than men. On the other hand, international radio is clearly a male-dominated pastime. Two women living in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the USA have decided to set up a newsletter to discuss programmes on shortwave from a women's perspective.
We've mentioned this initiative on the Radio Netherlands programme East of Edam last year, and it seems the idea has now turned into reality. Nina Allen is one of the editors of Wavelength, and we asked her whether there had been much response.
That's our first issue. We plan a second one, but it won't be immediately. We have gotten some response from women, and that's what we're looking for, of course, is getting it out, getting the word out has been slow, but it's happening.
There have been theories that because women's hearing patterns are generally different to those of men, they become more quickly irritated by the high-pitched whistles and heterodynes associated with long-distance listening. Nina, though, isn't convinced.
I had not heard that, and I am aware that at least the statistics tell us that there are not so many listeners. But I think that there's more listeners than are visible in mailbags. Some of our correspondents have complained that the programming is more male-oriented. It varies from country to country, but I think they would like to see more programs produced by and about women.
If you're interested, then drop a line to Nina Allen, editor of Wavelength, P.O. Box 381766, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the zip code is 02238-1766 in the USA. Address again, P.O. Box 381766, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02238-1766 in the USA. There's also a fax number, which is 1 for the US, and then 617-489-1249. That's 617-489-1249.
Media Network Book Review.
And to lead through a rather unusual publication, here is Andy Sennett.
Yes, it's a book whose cover bears a rather exciting subtitle, Confessions of the KGB Agent. The sleeve notes refer to a story as tension-packed as a James Bond adventure. But why are we reviewing a book like that on Media Network? Well, the author, Oleg Tumanov, worked for 20 years at American-run Radio Liberty in Munich. So I picked up the book in anticipation of discovering some secrets about what goes on behind the scenes at that particular radio station.
Did you?
Sadly, Diana, I have to report that for me, the book didn't live up to the billing. To put this in context, maybe I should mention that I did Russian and Soviet studies at university, and I was actually taught by a Soviet spy, who was a sweet middle-aged lady with a grown-up family. Then I went to work at BBC Monitoring, where it was always assumed that there was at least one Soviet spy on the staff at any given moment. So the whole notion of spying, I'm afraid, doesn't do much to get my adrenaline going. But I was fascinated by the idea of an inside glimpse of Radio Liberty. And therein lies the real disappointment, because there's actually very little about the radio station which hasn't been revealed already.
But how did a Soviet spy get to work there in the first place?
Well, Tumanov spends a very long time describing the events leading up to his arrival in Germany, but in a nutshell, he joined the Soviet Navy and jumped ship in darkness when his ship was in the Mediterranean near the border between Egypt and Libya. The plan was that he would surrender to the Americans, who had a military base in Libya, not far from where he landed, and declare himself to be a defector. All this, of course, had been carefully planned by the KGB.
But he didn't go straight to Radio Liberty, presumably?
No, he first had some contacts with the anti-Soviet emigre organization, the NTS. This, of course, was good form for someone wishing to convince others of his credentials as a defector. And that's where I found my first disappointment with the narrative. Tumanov refers to meetings with people who ran the NTS newspaper, but as older listeners to Media Network will recall, the NTS also had a shortwave radio station, which used to put out short broadcasts of about 10 minutes duration and constantly move frequency to avoid jamming. Very little was known about this station at the time, and I was hoping that Tumanov would at least refer to its existence, but there's absolutely no mention of it.
But he does say a bit more about Radio Liberty.
He does, but much of the time he's discussing the people who work there, and there's not much about how the programs were actually put together. The picture Tumanov paints is not a pretty one. There's a lot about internal dissension, drunkenness, and general incompetence. Strangely enough, throughout all of this, one never gets a clear picture of Tumanov himself. He writes the whole time as a detached observer, as if he were on the outside looking in. And the only time he says much about his own role in events is when it shows him up in a good light. There's little, if any, self-criticism. Tumanov clearly likes himself a whole lot more than he likes everyone else. Let's look at how he describes one of the most historic days of his time at Radio Liberty.
Late on the night of August the 20th, 1968, the telephone rang in my apartment. Oleg, this is Peransky speaking. Come immediately to the office. Soviet troops have occupied Czechoslovakia.
Peransky was at that time the head of news at Radio Liberty, a position Tumanov himself was later to occupy.
Peransky had the bad habit of telephoning his subordinates at night, sometimes with good reason, sometimes without. He'd be drinking somewhere, and at the same time would dial someone. Are you out of your mind, Sasha? Have you had to drop too much? His reply, in coarse language and sober voice, was simple. Oleg, I beg of you, come as quickly as you can. I'm phoning everyone, but I get no answers, and time's running out.
The problem was that in those days, the station didn't run a 24-hour shift system in the news department. the nighttime programming was normally all pre-recorded. Once at the station, Tamana found himself involved in a series of heated discussions about whether the station should react to the news or wait for confirmation. Tamana was asked to write a commentary, which he did. Meanwhile, senior management arrived to take control of things.
Late that evening, we were called together by Robert Tuck, director of the Russian service. He announced that he'd been instructed to put all our efforts into reporting events in Czechoslovakia. We'd be working in two 12-hour shifts, midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock to midnight.
Yes, that bit confuses me too, but we're quoting word for word from Tamana's narrative.
In addition, and here Tuck's voice took on a triumphant note, we have instructions to make use of the full power of Liberty's transmitters. America will spend whatever's needed to ensure that any jamming of our programs is suppressed.
3 days later, the Russian section was permitted to do a live broadcast at 8 p.m. Moscow time. But, Tamana reveals, there was an unexpected problem.
Our announcers flatly refused to broadcast live. It was one thing to know that you were dictating onto a tape. You could correct any mistakes. But it was quite different to communicate directly with the listeners.
Then comes the bit where Tamanov can't resist blowing his own trumpet.
Bob Tuck then recalled how we'd worked together on the night of the emergency, and in particular my heroic efforts. All right, he said to the veteran announcers, you can put in some training, and while you're doing it, you'll be replaced by this young man. The first program went on the air on August the 23rd. On the other side of the glass separating the studio from the producer's control panel, I could see the whole management of Radio Liberty. They were drinking whiskey. People were visibly nervous. I was too. For the first time in the history of Liberty, the announcer was speaking live to listeners. When I successfully completed the program, there was no end to their delight. Although it was already night, the American bosses hauled us off to celebrate in one of the more expensive bars. From then on, for many days in a row, at exactly 8 o'clock, I took my place at the microphone.
You know, Diana, when reading these passages, the thought struck me that this must have been the moment when Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe, too, first became seriously established as information providers to the countries in the Eastern Bloc. Before that, it was their role as propaganda tools which had taken prominence. There's a good deal of irony in the fact that the very first person to broadcast live on Radio Liberty should have been a Soviet double agent, even though they didn't know it for another 17 years.
So what happened to Tumanov eventually? Where is he now?
Well, he received a coded message one morning in his apartment at 6 o'clock. Within a few hours, he'd reached Berlin and crossed into the east through a secret door in one of the underground tunnels. He's now back in Moscow. He's unemployed and apparently living on a state pension, even though he's still only 50. He seems to be finding it hard to come to terms with the new situation in Russia.
But overall, you weren't too impressed with the book.
In terms of content, not really. I must admit that once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. But that was because I kept thinking I must be getting near to the really gripping part. Unfortunately for me, at least, it never came. I can't help thinking that the KGB, which had to approve the text, probably took some of the most interesting material out. And I've already mentioned that Tamanov appears lacking in humility, yet all too eager to point out the faults in others. A word of praise, though, for the translator, David Floyd, who has managed to render the original Russian text in a way which makes the book very easy to read. And that can't be said of all the Russian books I've read.
Well, if you want to make up your own mind, the book is called Tumanov, and it's published in the USA by Q, Incorporated of Illinois, at a cover price of $21.95. The ISBN number is 086715-2699. And if your native language is German, the book's also available in a German edition with the same ISBN number. Back to the bands, and the European DX Council Conference in Denmark is less than a couple of weeks away. I hope to be there in person, and Victor Gruntilica, our Asian media expert, will be there as well. There'll also be a report on this programme on June the 8th, but they'll be broadcast direct from the conference centre.
One of the organisers, Stig Hartvig Nielsen, tells me that for 3 hours a day during the four-day conference, they have obtained permission to operate a special low-power shortwave station. It will be activated from June the 2nd to the 5th inclusive, in one-hour blocks starting at 8, 16 and 22 hours UTC. The first two transmissions will use frequencies in the range 7400 to 7600 kHz and 15375 to 15800 kHz. The evening broadcast at 22 hours will use frequencies in the range 3950 to 4000 kHz and 7400 to 7600 kHz. The transmitter site is very near the conference site in Odense, and the power will be about 500 watts at the maximum. More information on the conference, incidentally, by faxing this number. 45 for Denmark, and then 6597427. Once again, that's 45 for Denmark, and then 6597427. Now over to our propagation wizard and us, Mike Bird on the line from Melbourne. Mike, what's it been like over the last 7 days?
Well, Diana, the solar flux increased and the geomagnetic field was generally unsettled until Tuesday when it became stormy. Solar activity was low all week and no solar flares were reported. The solar flux was 78 on Wednesday the 10th. On Thursday it dropped to 77 and by Tuesday the 16th it had climbed to 90. The average works out to 81.8, which equals an effective sunspot number of 22, and that's up on the previous week's level of 12. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, ranged between 5 and 30, which represents quiet to minor storm conditions. The magnetic field was generally unsettled until Tuesday the 16th, when it became stormy around 6 hours UTC. It then ranged between storm and unsettled conditions throughout Tuesday and early Wednesday.
And what about between now and next Thursday, May the 25th?
IPS Radio and Space Services expects solar activity will remain low. The geomagnetic field should hopefully be unsettled today and tomorrow. Between Saturday and Wednesday, we are expecting another coronal hole to produce at least active conditions.
Thanks, Mike. And that's where we close the media files for today. Jonathan and I will be back next week. In the meantime, why not sample some of the other great features on the air between now and next Thursday here on Radio Netherlands.